Accession number 29424, reel number 5.
I'm sorry if I had to peer at this, Paul, but it's the lighting and it's perfect otherwise. Paul Oestreicher, reel 5. You mentioned earlier, Paul, the Baader-Meinhof group, and I know you had... You had actually done some work with them. No, Paul, if I could ask you about this now. First of all, people listening to this might not know anything about them. So I wonder if you could start by saying, you know, what they were and what they had done.
Yes. We have to now think of the 1960s and 1970s. The 1960s, of course, were a period of young generation revolt against tradition, and especially in Germany, young people asking, what did you do when the Nazis were in power? Young people very disaffected with the older generation. And that student revolt in the 70s tended to peter out. And a minority of those involved felt, well, peaceful protest is useless. It gets us nowhere. Nothing has really changed. And they became a group of urban terrorists who thought the only way to change this system is really to challenge it violently and to become, if necessary, martyrs to building a dream society which they based on their version, really, of Marxist-Leninism. So they wanted to become revolutionaries who would completely, as it were, turn West German society upside down. There were similar groups in Italy and in other parts of Europe. Well, that led in the 70s to battles on the streets. It led to the murder of prominent citizens, businessmen, and the sort of symbols of West German society. And inevitably, of course, the leaders of this group were in the end rounded up and imprisoned. And I think in the mid-70s, there were something like 40 or 50 members of what became known as the Baader-Meinhof gang, because Baader and Meinhof were two of the key personalities. In German, they were not so described. They were usually described with the funny English RAF, which had nothing to do with Royal Air Force, but which is Red Army Faction. This is how they described themselves. When imprisoned, they clearly felt their battle was not yet over. They still had to fight for their beliefs from inside the prisons. And they had a set of lawyers who were basically on their side. I mean, the lawyers themselves had not been violent, had not broken the law, but were really a support group. So you got the prisoners inside the prisons and their lawyers supporting what they stood for outside the prisons, fighting for different prison conditions. They claimed they were being tortured, they claimed they were being isolated, and indeed in some cases they were isolated and put in solitary confinement. And so prison conditions then became the subject of a new battle. And at one stage, about 25 of them in 6 different prisons, all coordinated by their lawyers, went on hunger strike. And this hunger strike became very threatening, threatening to their lives, because they said, we will fast to death, on the one hand, and those who were not in prison said, for every prisoner who dies, we will kill a prominent citizen outside. And in fact, just that happened. A prisoner called Holger Mainz actually died. And within a week, one of the Supreme Court judges in Berlin, his name was Drankmann. It's amazing that I actually remember these names, because I'm not good at remembering names, was murdered. Well, you can imagine how tense that situation was. It is at this point that the sister of one of the prisoners, the prisoner's name was Ingrid Schubert, who was in prison in Munich, Her sister was actually married to an English lawyer and lived in England and came to see me. Now, I was at the British Council of Churches, and I was also chairman. I had been chairman of Amnesty International, was well known to be acquainted with the whole problem of political prisoners, and I spoke fluent German, but I was outside the situation. And she came to me and said, "We need someone to mediate between the prisoners and the prison authorities to see if this strike can be ended peacefully without more deaths. And we think you're the sort of person who might be acceptable on the one hand to the prisoners and on the other to the West German government authorities. Would you take this mediation role on if the two sides of the battle are prepared to accept you?" Which was not, you couldn't take that for granted, that they would. And also the problem was that none of these prisoners were what Amnesty International would call prisoners of conscience. They were prisoners justifiably imprisoned for acts of violence, which makes them in no sense prisoners that Amnesty International would care for. And here was me, known to be working for Amnesty. Now, could I get involved with these prisoners, who are not prisoners of conscience? Well, I said, I will take on this task, provided it is anonymous and happens without any publicity. The moment this becomes a public enterprise, I don't think I could do it. But behind the scenes, quietly, I'm prepared to take it on. And so I went to Germany, and first of all, I conferred with the prisoners' lawyers. Frankly, they did not impress me as a set of people. I found myself very much ill at ease in their presence. But nevertheless, I persuaded them to accept me in that role. And having persuaded the prisoners' lawyers, I could be reasonably assured that these lawyers would persuade the prisoners to accept me. Then I went to the Ministry of Justice in Bonn, and it so happened that Hans-Jochen Vogel was Minister of Justice. Now, he is somebody whom I have always greatly respected, a fellow Christian, a member of the Social Democratic Party. This was in the time of Willy Brandt's government. And he and I hit it off very well. And he, as Minister of Justice, was the key person who would have to approve. And he did. On the other hand, he would also have to persuade the attorney, the equivalent of what we call the Attorney General, who is in fact the state prosecutor, who actually has immediate control of the prisons in the German system. His name was Buback. He would also have to be persuaded to accept me. Well, he was much more reluctant, but he did. And so, as it were, I had everybody lined up. So I proceeded now in a series of visits to prisons in Berlin, in Hamburg, in Mainz, and above all in Stuttgart, because it was in Stuttgart that the leadership group of the prisoners, Bader, Meinhof, Enslin, and Jan Karl Rasper, these four were sort of the ringleaders, and they were all imprisoned in the same prison. And so Stuttgart became the kind of pivotal point of my negotiating with the prisoners. And my task, of course, was to persuade people, all of them passionately committed to a violent crusade to change society. From my own point of view, as a pacifist, of course, totally wrong-headed, idealists. I could underwrite some of the ideals, but I couldn't write a single one of their methods of going about achieving them. So, of course, that was a big hurdle. But as a Christian, as a human being, I knew the only way I could achieve this was to go into their cells, which is what I had to do, you know, I had to talk to them individually, and I was permitted to do so by the authorities, to go into their cells and totally respect them as fellow human beings. With anything less than respect, I couldn't have achieved a thing.
Was that easy to do for
you? No, it was very difficult. And they made it difficult for me. They were in no mood to be nice to me. They actually saw me as representing the kind of society they were fighting. And yet they had been persuaded, talking to me, persuaded by their lawyers, that talking to me might in the end be in their own interest. And of course, my purpose was to persuade them that to end their hunger strike was in their own interest. That was the whole point of my talking to them, that killing themselves would really achieve nothing, and that this sort of martyrdom would not advance their political cause, and that there were better ways, that, you know, there were ways of educating themselves further while in prison, there were ways of eventually looking forward to their release, and giving them hope that there were other ways of fighting their battle that were not violent, but that, you know, would save their own lives.
How easy was it for them to open up to you? You know,
I suppose what I learned most from the experience, that it's very wrong, even a group with that much solidarity with each other, to see them as anything other than each individual is different. No two conversations were just the same as, you know, they were all different personalities. Bear in mind that some of them by now, they were in the, I don't know which week of the hunger strike, they were very weak. Some of them were not able to get up out of bed. Others were still pretty vigorous. But they were in various states of ill health, self-caused, of course. And they were not being force-fed. That was one of the big debates in the judicial system in Germany. Should we compulsorily feed them and thereby stop them from killing themselves? And the view on the whole was, we will not force feed them. If they want to kill themselves, well, so be it. Seemed to be the prison authorities' attitude. And I agreed with that. I said, "You people have the right not to eat, and if they choose to kill themselves, that's, in the end, that's their right, however one might disapprove of it." And yes, the real lesson that I learnt was treat them each as a unique individual. Most of them, I mean, some of them were obviously much more intelligent than others. Some of them were followers, and others were leaders. It became very plain that Bader, whose name went with the leading group, was not really very intelligent. He was a swashbuckling adventurer who didn't really understand all this ideological stuff they were fighting for. Whereas his girlfriend, Gudrun Enslin, was a brilliant intellectual who'd fallen for this young swashbuckling adventurer. She was really the brains of the outfit. And of course, it was very interesting that the authorities actually, because the prison system in Germany and in Britain and most countries isolates men from women, but they didn't. They allowed these Bader-Meinhof prisoners, four of them, in one wing of the prison, all on their own, and able to see each other, able to visit each other's cells.
It's very surprising.
Yeah, and they claimed they were being isolated. Well, it's true that they were being isolated from other prisoners, but they were not isolated from each other. They had a whole library of books they were allowed to have. And they were in many ways privileged. And I could tell the prison guards were afraid of them, rather than the other way around. So it was a very, very strange atmosphere. All of them passionately believed in their struggle, with one exception. And that was Meinhof. Ulrike Meinhof was a middle... Most of them came from the middle classes. They were not working class kids, any of them, as far as I remember. But Meinhof had grown up as a well-known, nationally well-known, liberal television journalist who made brilliant programs about society, about humanizing society. I mean, she was well known, you know, she was a star figure in the German media world. And making these programs about society, in the end she became disgusted with her own fame and said, you know, I'm the star, but I'm not changing anything. So she went into a phase of what I would call Franciscan simplicity, of self-denial, which included leaving her own children and her husband, and became a kind of a spiritual recluse, throwing herself back on prayer and changing society by sort of holiness. And having gone through that phase, she said, that doesn't work either, that's self-indulgent. And then she joined the violent group and became one of the leaders of it, because she was very well known, very intelligent, you know, her name gave the whole group a kind of uplift. But by the time she got into this hunger strike, in contrast to the others, she had fallen into despair. In other words, she's tried everything. Now she's tried violence, and it wasn't working either. And she'd become a nihilist. She didn't care any more about anything. And talking to her was like talking to a dead person. And you really felt her hunger strike was not a battle anymore. She'd just given up. I might as well kill myself. What's the point? She was the only one like that. All the others saw the point. They thought, if we kill ourselves, that would be part of the struggle. You know, we'll be martyrs to the struggle. But not her. She was like a hollow person, sort of, you know, T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men. I really felt one of the few cases in my life where I've talked to somebody where I felt life has no more meaning for her.
How difficult to deal with someone like that.
That's right.
Yes. What was your approach?
Well, you know, in her case, I almost became a Christian missionary again. I said, look, you know, God loves you, and in the end, love still exists. You still have two children whom you could go back to. You've got something to live for. But I didn't feel I'd made any impact by talking like that. One of the most interesting episodes of this was in Hamburg prison, where the prisoners were still... they started the hunger strike rather later. In other words, they were still physically very fit. And rather than going into their cells, the prison authorities brought them to an interview room together. So I faced... I can't now accurately remember, was it two of them or three of them sitting opposite me across a table? It was the only situation where I talked to a group of them rather than to just singly. And that was quite eerie, because hanging over their heads, a prison chaplain had obviously hung a text on the wall by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which actually said, the text said, you will never be able to help anyone whom you do not respect. And that was an amazing text, you know. It was really, I felt this was talking to me. I can't do anything for these three people unless I really respect them. You know, that was a kind of strange interlude for me. I mean, I knew that to be the case, but to have it written on the wall, literally behind them, they were facing them, was quite an extraordinary experience.
Almost like you're being spoken to.
Exactly. That's right. Almost. That's right. Well, the long and the short of it was, by the end of my attempts to change their mind, I think largely because of my intervention, but I wouldn't say solely because of it. There must have been other factors dictating the opinions of their lawyers, because their lawyers were such an important factor in all this. In the end, they did decide during the hunger strike. So you could say I was a factor in saving their lives. And almost simultaneously with that, when it looked as though that would happen, somebody spilt the beans of my mission to Spiegel, the German news magazine. And suddenly my presence became a matter of sensational public interest. Well, at that moment I knew I'd done my job. I knew I'd done all I could do. And for me to then become an object of major public debate could only make things worse. So I pulled out immediately. But strangely, it was at the moment when I think the lawyers and the prisoners had decided to stop the hunger strike. For reasons that I think were not only what I'd said, but were a whole lot of factors. So it was a very profound experience for me, spiritually, I would say. And it was not, in the long term, successful, in the sense that Bader, Meinhof, Enslin, and Rasper, as well as Ingrid Schubert in Munich, who was in a different prison, in the end, all did kill themselves. But much later, at a much later stage of their imprisonment. And in the case of Bader Meinhof and Enslin, very dramatically. But the first to kill themselves, and in this case, I was quite certain she had done it on her own initiative. Ulrike Meinhof hanged herself on bedsheeting in her cell. The other three, several days later, and this, of course, is a major unsolved criminological story in the West German prison system, the other three shot themselves with pistols. How did they get them? Their followers said they were murdered and did not kill themselves. The official version was they shot themselves. I don't think that conundrum will ever be finally resolved. How in a high security prison, where everybody, including their lawyers, were allegedly, and I was, virtually strip searched every time we went in, how do they get access to guns and ammunition? The most plausible theory is still they persuaded their lawyers to smuggle them in, and the lawyers somehow knew how. But it's not very plausible. The idea that the authorities actually gave them pistols to shoot themselves, a corrupt prison guard smuggled them in. I mean, the prison guards could do that, of course, maybe in the hope that they would kill themselves, is another theory. And the final one is that they were actually murdered in the prison, which was their own propaganda version. No one will ever know, I don't think.
Still unsolved.
I mean, the official version remains that someone smuggled the guns into them. In other words, that security failed, and they then killed themselves.
Did in your talks with these, and you know, it's so interesting, and the way you related to them as individuals, not as a sort of group, mm. or, you know, with similar backgrounds and values. Did religion ever come into any of your talks with them on an individual level? Any of them, you were saying how Meinhof had actually turned to religion as one at one time.
At Wasn't one time, with with Meinhof, you could at least use religious language and expect her to understand it. In the, your question about Enslin is fascinating, because Gudrun Enslin is a daughter of an evangelical pastor and his wife, and was brought up in, you know, what we would call fundamentalist Christianity. She was brought up as a very strict young Christian, and totally rejected this. Rebelled against it in what she was doing. But in my opinion, she rebelled against fundamentalist religion, but remained a fundamentalist. She needed a fundamentalist faith of some kind. It was a different one, but her mindset was the same. She rejected one form of fundamentalism for another. And this is confirmed for me because I went to visit her parents. Now, strangely, her pietistic Christian parents, or particularly her father, shows how emotional parents can be, bought into their daughter's protest. I mean, in other words, instead of being angry with their daughter for being what she was like, somehow they empathized with her and accepted the thesis that their daughter had been murdered, and more or less took her side, although you'd think from their evangelical Christian point of view her daughter was a total rebel. But quite strangely, the parents, somehow blood was thicker than water, you know, was thicker than anything else, and became emotionally attached to this daughter. And the one sentence of her mother, I will never forget, when her mother said to me, "If only we hadn't brought her up so strictly." In other words, you know, we imposed this fundamentalist mindset on her, and she never lost it. And she, and in the end, the mother understood what had happened.
If you say one for another, she replaced.
That's right. And the mother kind of grasped what that meant, that her upbringing had actually been damaging, had not given her any flexibility of mind. If she, you know, she had to be 100% this, or if she was going to rebel, she was going to have to be 100% the opposite. So that too was an eerie experience.
Yes, they sound a very... You know, obviously very distasteful what they did, but a very interesting group of young people. You know,
that's right. And of course,
violence.
They were pariahs in West German society. They were hated by sort of ordinary middle class people from which these children had come. And one very moving experience that I had was after Gudrun Enslin's death, however she died, a journalist who had been head of religious broadcasting in Stuttgart, and who to this day is one of my closest friends, indeed he and his wife are going to come and live in our Brighton flat over the summer holidays, and we're going to live in their Berlin flat. He's retired, he's 70 now and retired. Well, he realized the Enslin family needed to be allowed to mourn publicly.